Welcome to Backyard Bookshelf, an audio journal program intended for a print-impaired audience that features fiction, nonfiction, and other readings with a local connection. I'm Charlene, and for the next hour, I'll be reading Episode 1 of The Devil's Elbow by Ed Lundgren. Set in colonial Massachusetts, The Devil's Elbow follows Jack Parker from his orphan childhood days as an apprentice to a greedy and brutal Boston merchant to the isolated pioneer settlement of Brookfield, where he ends up in the fight of his life to protect the people and places he loves. The knowledge Jack's father gave him, that the measure of a man is how he deals with the worst life can throw at him, the support of the powerful man who becomes his friend, and deep, unshakable love for the childhood girlfriend who becomes his wife, fuel Jack's determination and will to survive. All Jack has learned on his 8-year journey meets its greatest test when he and 98 others are trapped in a 4-room tavern for 3 hot, humid August days, fighting for survival against 400 once friendly Indians, who are determined to wipe them out and reclaim their land and way of life. This book is dedicated to Karen Brown, Kathy Gardner, Vern Lubbs, and Sonny Anderson. July 7th, 1695. In the following pages, I will tell you a story. I am older now, and some of the things I'll relate happened more than 30 years ago, although to me, it seems as if they happened only yesterday. While I do not consider myself an accomplished teller of stories, I will do what I can with the abilities I have so that you will know all that happened and why. And while I do not have what many call a formal education, as mine stopped at the time the story begins, my curiosity and attention to detail has always served me well. Certain memories from this time make me smile, and though it was a difficult existence, there were many simple things and many people that brought me great pleasure. We tend to forget details as the years progress, and our memories of the good tend to outweigh the bad, and I, like all other men, am subject to the same influence. Chapter 1. The greatest grief that can happen to a boy happened to me when I was 14 years old. No matter what happened, life was never to be the same again. My world turned upside down when my mother died while giving birth on that cold and dismal morning of April 7th, 1665, leaving me, Jack Parker, an orphan in the coastal town of Ipswich, located 30 miles north of Boston, in the Massachusetts Bay Colony. I found that there are times in life when you feel all alone, as if no one else cares about your very existence. Although that's rarely the case, it just feels that way. That's how I felt, alone and abandoned, not knowing what to do or even where to start. Scared of everything, scared of losing what little I had. It was a terrible time, for my entire world was gone. My father died the previous fall in a hunting mishap of which I was the cause. I blame myself for my father's death because if I hadn't been so careless, he wouldn't have had to save me and he wouldn't have gotten sick. It is a burden I carried then and carry still. He and I were hunting one cold, windy, late October morning, several miles from home along the Ipswich River. I went charging down a steep bank, which was slick from 2 days of rain, to the river to get a fat raccoon he had shot. I slipped and fell, rolling and tumbling, until I landed face down in the cold water. I stood up, took a step, and fell into a deep hole, the water closing over my head. My father jumped in to save me, but as he began to pull me out, he fell and went under, pulling me down with him. By the time he dragged me to shore, we were soaking wet from head to foot, choking on the water we swallowed, water draining from our clothes into our shoes, and shivering in the wind that made it feel much colder. By the time we got home, both of us were shaking with chills, My hands and feet were tingling and my face was numb. My mother took care of getting us warm and dry, making us sit near the roaring fire in dry clothes, covered in blankets, eating warm vegetable stew, and drinking hot cider. I recovered by the next day, but my father developed a cough that came from deep in his chest. For the next 2 days, he was very sick and unable to get out of bed, burning with a high fever while shaking with constant chills. During the one time he was awake, he called me to his side and told me in a harsh, rasping voice to take good care of my mother, that I had always been a good boy, and he knew I would grow to be a good man. The last thing he ever said to me was that no matter what happens to you, there is an inner strength that will never leave you unless you let someone take it away, and that the measure of a man is determined by how he faces life's difficulties. He passed away that afternoon. If I didn't have my Aunt Charity and Uncle Josiah, I don't know what I would have done. My aunt was a wonderful woman, patient, kind, always happy, and always smiling. She came from the town of Sandwich on Cape Cod to take care of her ailing sister and meet Josiah at the Sabbath meetings soon after she arrived. They began to spend time with each other, and when her sister recovered, Charity didn't return home. Josiah was an independent-minded man and had little tolerance for many of the practices of the day. Like my father, he was not a particularly religious man. He didn't like many of the ministers he met, as he believed they thought they were far superior to the rest of us, which they did. Charity, on the other hand, made sure Josiah went to meeting every Sabbath, whether he wanted to or not. While they had a good but hard life, as most of us did, the one thing they did not have was children. After 3 years of marriage, it was clear that Charity couldn't have children, which was a tremendous disappointment to them both. Because she was barren, there was talk about how God was punishing her and Josiah. No one ever said what they were being punished for, but hints of the various causes, none of them good, surfaced from time to time. Although no one said anything to her, Charity knew the rumors were out there and that she was talked about by other people, mostly women, and it hurt her more than any of them would ever know. My mother was 3 months pregnant when my father died. They were excited about it because having another baby was a wonderful thing, especially after losing my little sister 3 years before to a high fever and whooping cough that lasted almost a month. She was 6 years old when she died. There were times when my mother didn't feel well for a day or two, and as her time came near, she reassured me daily, telling me not to be concerned and that everything would be fine. However, I could see the worry in her eyes when she'd suddenly clutch her belly, grimacing with momentary pain. My mother went into labor early in the morning, shortly after Josiah and Charity arrived. She was very glad to see them. Within a short while, my mother began to have strong pains. Charity sent me to get the midwife and Mrs. Morgan, my mother's best friend, so they could help her with the birth. When they arrived, Josiah and I left the house, knowing this was a place for women only. We were outside a few minutes when Charity came to the door. "Josiah," she said, "take Jack and go somewhere." With that, she closed the door. He looked down at me, knowing there was nothing we could do but leave. He gave a deep sigh as he put his hand on my shoulder. "Come on, Jack, let's find us something to do." As we walked away, he grumbled, for he didn't like being told what to do, not even by his own wife. We walked around a good part of the town for the first half of the morning. We visited three of his friends' farm, but didn't stay long when they asked us to help with some work. Josiah never minded working hard, just not for someone else. I remember we stopped at the tavern on our way back. It was a low, dark room with a large fireplace that always had a measly little fire burning. There were three or four men drinking rum and lounging about. Walter, the tavern keeper, was a tall, barrel-chested, broad-shouldered man with a black, bushy beard. Walter always doted on children. More than once, he slipped a piece of maple candy into my hand when my father wasn't looking while giving me a wink. We got back to the house after a couple of hours and were surprised to find that my mother hadn't given birth yet. Josiah went in only to be pushed out by Mrs. Morgan. A short while later, we heard the baby cry. The midwife came to the door and motioned to Josiah. He went and spoke with her and came back smiling. He told me that I had a baby brother, a strong and lusty lad, and that's the exact phrase he used. I saw two of my friends and ran over to tell them. When I came back, Josiah was talking in low tones to the midwife, who was trying to explain something to him. He began to step into the house, but was stopped by the midwife's assistant. Josiah said something, pushed her out of the way, and shut the door behind him. I wandered in front, waiting for him to come out. When he finally did, he was upset and waved his arm for me to follow him. We went into the back near the barn, where he stood facing away from me. He took a deep breath and gave a loud sigh before turning and squatting in front of me. "Jack, something went wrong after the baby was born. Your mother was hurt very bad inside, and something happened. She was bleeding, and they couldn't stop it. There was nothing they could do." He took a deep breath and looked at the ground. He raised his head, looked me in the eye, and spoke in almost a whisper. "She died a few minutes ago." I stood there stunned, the rest of the world ceasing to exist for me. I didn't hear or see anything. I began to wander about in a daze, moving as if in a dream. I went to him and looked into his face. "No, you made a mistake. My mother is not dead. She can't be. I saw her just a little while ago. She can't be dead. She just can't be." I cried as a shudder ran through me. Part of me was sure they had made a mistake. My mother couldn't be dead. "I saw her just a while ago," I repeated. Josiah didn't say anything. He just looked at me with sad eyes. I saw a tear come from his left eye and make its way down his cheek. It began to dawn on me that he wasn't lying and that my mother was dead. I ran to the house and hit the door hard, causing it to open and slam against the wall. The women turned and looked at me, all of them crying. "No," I yelled and began to cry. They were around the bed, so I couldn't see her. "I want to see her. I don't believe you," I said, even though I realized that it was the truth. Charity came and wrapped her arms around me as I began to cry hard for what seemed like a long time. She held me the whole time, patting my back and telling me it would be all right and not to worry. After I stopped crying, she wiped my face with her apron and ran her hand over my hair. She pulled me close to her and started crying, so I joined in. We wept for a minute or two until Josiah put his hand on my shoulder, pulling me away from her. He turned me around and walked me out the door. I remember looking around, seeing Charity in the doorway, wiping her eyes with the back of her hand, looking at me in a way that was so sad that I started to blubber again. Josiah squatted and put his hand on my shoulder. I slapped it away and ran around the corner of the house, not knowing or caring where I was headed. I stayed around the corner for a minute, not knowing what to do, until I heard Charity's voice. "Josiah, take him away. Go to Minister Trumbull's or to Morgan's or somewhere, but just go. He doesn't need to be here right now." At that, I started to run, and after a few minutes, found myself by the side of a small stream. I'd come here before many times to sit by myself and watch the birds, skip rocks, or just watch the clouds float by. It was my special place. The sound of the gurgling water never failed to soothe me. I sat down, drew my legs up, and put my head against my knees, wrapping my arms around my legs. I kept hearing my uncle's words, "Your mother died. There was nothing anyone could do." I sat there for at least an hour, wondering what would happen to me now that everything I knew was gone. It was midday by the time I got up and started walking, not having any idea where I was going, but I wandered back to the house to see Josiah sitting outside waiting for me. As I got closer, he moved over on the bench, motioning for me to sit down. We sat for a few minutes without talking. After a while, he got off the bench, stood in front of me, and squatted so his eyes were at the same level as mine. "Jack, none of this is your fault. There was nothing you or I or anyone else could have done. She was taken for a reason, although I don't know what it could be." I stood, looked at him, and shrugged, listening but not hearing. We took my mother to the burial ground that afternoon. After I ran away, Charity and the other women put her in the shroud, while Josiah got the carpenter, James Gilbert, to build the coffin and James's brother to dig the grave. It only took a few minutes to bury her. I stood at the edge of the grave watching as they lowered her body into the gaping hole. A dozen or so people, friends of my parents or Charity and Josiah's, came to the burial and stood as the dirt was shoveled into the grave. I jumped hard when the first shovelful landed on the coffin, as it hit me that it was my mother, my own mother, in that box and soon should be covered with several feet of dirt. I shivered and gasped at the thought. We stayed for a few minutes, all of us lost in our own particular thoughts. I just couldn't believe she was gone. I was with her just that morning, just a few hours before, and now I would never see her again. In all my years, I have never gotten over the suddenness in which life is extinguished. A person is here among the living, and then in a few seconds, they're dead and gone. I looked up, wiping my eyes with the palm of my hand, and saw several of the women crying softly as their husbands put their arms around them to provide some comfort. Charity took a handkerchief from her pocket and wiped her eyes while giving me a weak smile. As we left the burial ground, Josiah walked in front of us, his head hung low. He brought his hand to his face several times to wipe away the tears we knew he was shedding, but would never let us see. I walked back to the house with everyone else, lost in a daze of sadness and confusion. As I went in, I looked around and remembered my mother sitting at her spinning wheel talking to my father on a cold October night last fall. They smiled and laughed, and it was warm, and we were happy. That was the day my mother told me she was having a baby. Charity went ahead of me and was on the other side of the room when I came in. She turned, looking at me with tear-reddened eyes, and put her arm around my shoulders, telling me it would be all right. I missed my mother. I wanted the pain and hurt to go away. She comforted me for a long time before I stopped sniffling. Then she gave me a cloth to wipe my face. While Charity reassured me, Josiah went around us and built up the fire, adding 3 good logs that burned well. We stood to the front of the fire, oblivious to everyone else in the room, staring at the flames and wondering what the future would hold. Later that night, Charity came to sit next to me on the floor in front of the fire. We didn't talk for what seemed like a long time. I was tired and on the verge of falling asleep, my head bobbing up and down. She leaned over and helped me up and walked me to my bed. The last thing I remember is her talking about the baby. "I talked to Mrs. Fletcher today. The baby is doing well, and they'll be taking him. She lost a baby girl a little more than a week ago. The only problem is that they are moving to Groton next Monday." "I'm sorry, Jack." It made sense, but he was my brother, and I'd never, ever see, have seen him. I hoped that maybe at some point in the future, I would get to see him for at least a little while. The sadness came upon me in waves, with the pain following. As the days went by, I cried, but only when I was by myself, for I didn't want anyone to see or hear me. I'd go to the barn to stand in a corner, talking to my mother, telling her how much I missed her, and wishing she were there to hold and protect me. I was a sad, lost, and lonely young boy with a broken heart who couldn't understand why his parents were taken away from him. If they died when I was an infant, I would not have missed them, but that was not the case. A couple of days after my mother died, I was in the barn sniffling away when I heard footsteps behind me. I turned and saw Charity standing in the doorway. "I was wondering where you went," she said, looking at me. "What are you doing out here?" When I didn't respond, she came over to me and put her arms around me. She held me tight, slowly rocking back and forth. "Oh, I know how it hurts. We miss her very much, too. It will take time, but it will get better. I promise it will. Josiah and I will always be here for you. You never have to worry because we'll always be here to take care of you," she said, wiping my eyes with her apron before giving me another hug. "Come on now," she said, putting her hands on the back of my shoulders and pointing me in the direction of the house. "Dinner's ready." As we sat at the table, I looked across at my aunt and uncle and realized that we were all that was left of our family. The only other family I had left beside my aunt and uncle were several distant relatives I'd never met, and from what I'd heard of them, I didn't want to. As I lay in bed that night, my mind drifted back to the past. My memories of the time before my father died were good. Our house was not large, but on a cold fall day, it was warm, and the smell of the apple pies and pumpkin muffins my mother made could make me stay indoors all afternoon. I'd sit by the fire, making birch brooms or some other thing, but that was just an excuse for staying near her. I was cozy, warm, and happy. It always seemed that my father had other ideas for me on those days. "Come on, Jack," he'd say, tousling my hair as he walked by. "Let's go to the woods and shoot some partridge so your mother can make us pie and beans." He'd always say the same thing and then throw me my wool jacket. While I was getting ready, he'd wink at my mother, telling her that he was hungry and that we'd be back soon. This always made her laugh. My mother's beans were wonderful. The smell of molasses and fried salt pork would linger for hours. The thought of it still never fails to make me hungry. My stomach would rumble in anticipation the entire time we were gone. It made walking in the chilly wind on a rainy or snowy day bearable. For my mother's beans and partridge pie, I'd have stood in 3 feet of ice-cold water all afternoon in a 40-mile-an-hour wind. One of my greatest joys was my dog, Tinker, or Tink for short. He was a black beast of a dog and always seemed to think of himself as still a puppy, even though he must have weighed close to 90 pounds, which I knew well since he was forever trying to crawl onto my lap. He had warm brown, mischievous eyes, a shiny coat, and an unending desire to run and swim. He loved to go hunting with my father and me. He got a great deal of joy out of leaving the house early in the morning in the cool, crisp air. The minute he saw me get my gun, he'd begin to bark and whine because he knew where we were going. He got so excited that his tail would wag hard enough to cause him to move forward when he was sitting. His barking made us leave in a hurry just to get him to quiet down. The minute he was outside, he would dash off, his nose in the wind, running around just for the sheer pleasure of it. In many ways, he was a big, happy child. No matter how old I get, I smile when I think of him. We would visit Josiah and Charity often, always bringing good things to eat. Those were pleasant days when we forgot any cares or worries, and the food and family made for a wonderful time. My father and I always had some adventure in the works, whether it was hunting, fishing, or going to visit one of his friends, who would take us out into the bay on his small fishing boat. I didn't care that we did, because it was great just spending time with my father. Those are some of my most cherished memories. Wherever we went, Tink came along with us, whether we wanted him to or not, wagging his tail and giving me that goofy, happy look of his from time to time. As I recall the events and times of my childhood, more and more memories come to mind. I could go on and on, but leave it to say that for the most part, they were happy memories. Over the next several months, my aunt and uncle discussed what would be best for me, whether to go with them to their farm, or for them to stay here with me, or for us to go to a new settlement in the wilderness out in the western part of the colony. That excited me to no end with thoughts of adventures, Indians, hunting, and all the other things a young boy would love to do. The thought of staying in Ipswich didn't interest me in the least. I wanted to go somewhere, even though I wasn't sure where. They decided to stay at my house and rent their farm. Moving to a new settlement wasn't discussed any further. We stayed in Ipswich and worked my father's farm. This state of things continued for 2 years until they began discussing my future. I was shocked when I found out their decision. "Jack, we want to talk to you," Josiah said, motioning for me to sit at the table with them. "We want the best life for you, and we hope you know that. Both of us understand how difficult it's been for you over the last 2 years. We'll always be here for you and do everything we can to help you. We want you to have a better life than we do." They looked at each other and hesitated over what was to come next. My aunt leaned over and put her hand on my arm while giving me a weak smile. "Your uncle," she said, giving him a quick glance, "talked to Elijah Hapgood about a man he knows in Boston." She stopped, taking her hand away. "This man in Boston," Josiah said, picking up where she left off, "is a successful merchant with a coastal trading boat, a warehouse, and a tannery. He employs 2 coopers and a blacksmith and has a shop where he sells his goods. He's a wealthy man. Elijah told me that this man, Goodfield is his name, needs an apprentice and is looking for the right boy. When Elijah heard of it, he thought of you." It took me a minute to understand that they were saying that I should become the man's apprentice. The normal term for an apprentice was 7 years, although I'd heard of some of 4 or 5 years. The thought of all the things and people I'd leave behind went through my mind. "No," I exclaimed, "I don't want to. I don't want to be anyone's apprentice." I looked at them bewildered at the possibility of leaving my home. "I want to stay here. Why are you trying to get rid of me?" I asked. "Why is being an apprentice better than farming? If you and my father could do it, then so can I said, looking at Josiah. "We're not trying to get rid of you. Farming is hard work, and it takes its toll over the years. We want you to have a better life and more opportunities. This could be a good thing for you." "I'd be gone at least 5 years. I'd be 19 when I'm through. No, I won't go," I declared, wondering whether my protest would make them reconsider. They had to know that this was the last thing I wanted and that I'd rather do anything than go away for so long. "We understand how you feel, but I'm going to Boston tomorrow with Elijah to talk to Mr. Goodfield," he said. "Now go do your chores." I went out to the barn and sat on the floor. Picking a piece of hay out of the pile behind me, I began scratching the dirt with it. It wasn't fair that they wanted me to go away. It was all too much for me to take in at once. My mother and father were gone. My brother was living with the Fletchers who moved to Groton, and now Josiah and Charity wanted me to leave the only home I'd ever known. Gone for 5 years. Maybe I'd never be able to return, I thought, shocked at the way my life could change in just a few days. I began to panic. I wouldn't be able to see my friends and their families as I went around the village or to the Sabbath meeting. I'd also miss Becky Morgan, the 12-year-old daughter of my mother's best friend, Elizabeth Morgan. I found myself liking her more and more. She and her mother were always very kind to me, and even more so since my mother passed away. I realized I'd miss her smile and her laugh, the way she'd make fun of me when I did something she thought to be foolish. Becky wasn't home when I got there. She was at a neighbor's house, but her mother expected her home in a little while. While I waited, I sat outside on the small rise to the side of their house, watching the waves roll across the cove. There was a steady wind blowing off the ocean, moving a small coastal trader along at a good clip. I saw her coming down the road and ran to meet her. As I got closer, I saw her smiling at me and realized that I was smiling too. It was just good to see her. My smile disappeared at the thought that I might not see her for a long time. "What's wrong?" she asked, grabbing onto her bonnet as the wind gusted. "Josiah and Charity want me to become an apprentice," I blurted out. "What?" she asked, with her eyes flying open in surprise. "Where? When? They're just talking about this, aren't they? Josiah's going to Boston tomorrow to talk to some wealthy merchant Eliza Hapgood knows. I just can't believe they'd do something like that. They said they want a good life for me. They want me to learn a trade, something that would give me greater opportunities than staying and working on the farm," I said. "I don't know. This happened all of a sudden. I don't know what to do. I never thought about anything like this." What do they mean, a good life? You can have a good life without going to Boston or being an apprentice. Have you talked to them? Told them you don't want to go?" "Yes, but it didn't do any good. We only talked about it for a few minutes. I need to change their mind and convince them that I shouldn't go. I just don't know how." "Oh, you'll figure it out. You always do. Make sure that they know it will be more difficult for them with you gone. They'll have to do more work. It won't be as easy for them as it would be if you stayed." "But they never had anyone to help out before they came to live with me, so not having me around wouldn't be a big loss for them." "I don't want to go," I said, looking at her with her hair blowing in the breeze, "because I'd never see you or anyone else I know for a long, long time. An apprentice lasts 5 or maybe even 7 years. I'd be at least 19 when I'm done." "You wouldn't be able to come home at all?" she asked. "I don't think so. It would be up to my master. An apprentice has to do what his master tells him, including where he goes, who he sees, and when." Becky squared her shoulders. "I need to talk to Charity about this," she said. "This just isn't right." Well, she talked to Charity, and I pleaded, trying to persuade them to let me stay, all to no end. Josiah met with the merchant and made all the arrangements. I was going to be an apprentice whether I wanted to or not. I was crestfallen when I found out that my hopes for an adventurous life were dashed. Even though I wanted to go somewhere, I did not want to go to Boston. Not that I hadn't been to Boston before. I had several times, but to live there away from my friends and the things that were familiar to me was too much to contemplate. I became resigned to my fate, awaiting the day I would leave with the same enthusiasm as if I was about to be flogged. Josiah and I left in the early morning, 2 days after he returned from meeting with Mr. Goodfield. The last people to see me off were Mrs. Morgan and Becky. While the adults talked, I told Becky that I wanted to walk down to the small beach a short distance away. We crossed a small hill and came to a sandy area with dunes and tall beach grass, continuing to the water without saying a word. We walked a small beach and turned when we reached the end, coming back to where we started. After a few minutes of staring at the ocean, I realized I had to get back. When I looked at her, I saw tears in her eyes. "What are you crying for?" I asked, a little annoyed at her sudden show of emotion. "Because I'll never see you again, Jack." She was looking at me in a way I had never seen before. "Don't cry. I have to get back now or Josiah will be mad. He's itching to leave." She reached out and took my right hand in hers and sniffled. "You have to kiss me," she whispered. "What? What are you talking about? Why do I have to kiss you? I don't want to kiss anybody, above all you." "It's the way you say goodbye when you know you'll never see that person again." I had to get back, so I decided it would be easier to let her have her way than take time arguing about it. "Now close your eyes," she said. I did, and felt her lips touch mine. She held the kiss for a moment until I pulled away. It was an odd but pleasant feeling, and not as bad as I thought it might be. I realized I enjoyed it. "Now I have to kiss you back," I said, surprised at myself. "Why?" "Because you kissed me, and now I want to kiss you." I bent and pressed my lips to hers, feeling a strange but thrilling sensation. I held it for a minute before pulling my face away little by little. When she looked at me, I saw how green her eyes were. She had a soft smile. I realized I was smiling too. "Now we have to get married," she stated. "What?" I exclaimed, flabbergasted at her pronouncement, backing a few steps away from her. "Why do we have to get married?" "Because when a boy and girl kiss more than once, it means they're going to marry." I didn't know what to say and was relieved when I heard Charity calling us. "We have to go now, Becky," I said. "I'll see you again, maybe sooner than you think." Whether I said that to comfort her or me, I don't know. She gave a slight smile and went up the dune with me. Conflicting emotions ran through me. Confusion over what just happened, excitement that I kissed a girl, frustration and anger that I had to go somewhere I didn't want to be. Chapter 2. When I got back, Tink was waiting for me with his tail wagging so hard his whole body moved back and forth. I looked at him and felt a big lump in my throat. How was I going to say goodbye to him? He had been my best friend since I was 6, and I might never see him again. I went down on my knees as he came at to me. I wrapped my arms around his neck, fighting back tears. "You're a good boy, Tink, always have been. I don't know what I'm going to do without you. It's just not fair. I shouldn't have to leave you. I just shouldn't have to." He stopped wagging, tilted his head to one side, looking at me with his big brown eyes. It's like he was listening to me. I could tell that he knew. Somehow he knew. He put his muzzle into my neck like he did when he was a puppy, so I hugged him and scratched his ears. His head went all the way over to one side, and his back legs started moving up and down like he was trying to scratch himself. "I wish I could bring you with me," I said as a few tears started to flow. I buried my face in his neck and held him tighter. "You be a good boy for them. I'll come home as soon as I can just to see you," I whispered. He started wagging again as Josiah came out the door. I said my goodbyes to Charity, patted Tink one last time, and got into the cart beside Josiah. Charity stood by the door, looking sad as we drove away. Tink sat next to her, looking first at her, then at me. I looked back and waved, wanting to shed a tear or two of my own, but I didn't. It wasn't long before we got to Boston. I've always found that it seems to take longer than you want it to when you're going somewhere you want to go, and a much shorter time to get someplace you'd rather not be. I thought about asking him to turn around and go home, but I knew Josiah wouldn't, so I didn't bother. Mr. Gordon Goodfield's house was halfway between the wharves and Beacon Hill. It was located on a semicircular street just up from Mendel's Cove, where the town docks jutted into the cove and ran along the left shore towards Gallup's Point. Mill Pond was to the east, just a short distance from the wharves. The house was close enough to the cove so that on all but the coldest days, the smell of fish, seaweed, and muck wafted from the water. As I was to see later, the harbor was a pretty place with several green islands off in the distance. The common was a short distance away in the direction of Tri-Mountain, or the Three Hills, Pemberton, Mount Vernon, and Beacon. The house was a large, dark brown, two-story dwelling with more windows than I'd ever seen in one house. It was at least four times the size of my house. It was tall, with the second floor jutting out several feet over the first, but only on the front side. The door was offset to the right side, making the house look unbalanced. Goodfield was a short, plump, but not quite fat man, with wiry brown hair and hazel eyes. He stood looking me up and down, as if trying to decide whether I was worth the time and trouble to take in. "Well," he said, continuing to stare at me as he addressed my uncle, "is he able to work hard? He doesn't eat too much, does he? There are others in the family, you know. I can't afford to have some boy eating all day long and not working as he should. That won't do. It just won't do. He'll have to work hard. Oh, yes, he will. We'll teach him how to write, read, and cipher. It's God's providence that you came to me, boy." "I already know how to do all that. My mother taught me to read, write, and cipher," I snapped. Both of them looked at me in surprise. Josiah, because of how angry I sounded, and Mr. Goodfield, because he didn't think a boy like me would know how to read, write, and do arithmetic. "Well, if you already know, I won't have to teach you. You'll have more time to work then," he said with a nasty grin. "And we have plenty of work." At that moment, he reminded me of a fat snake, its flat eyes staring at you just before it strikes. I didn't like the way this was going, and I could see Josiah was watching me. Not knowing what else to do, I shook my head back and forth to tell him that I didn't want to stay here. "Now, Goodman Clark, come in here and sign the papers," Goodfield said, motioning to Josiah but ignoring me. I started to follow, but Goodfield stopped me. "There's no need of you being here, boy. Now wait outside." With that, he closed the door in my face. I turned and looked around, up and down the street, watching the tradesmen go by. Boys, girls, men, and women were all working at something or other. It was a beehive of activity everywhere I looked. Men were rolling barrels, boys trundling wheelbarrows full of things, girls carrying baskets of cloth and vegetables, and women were tending their gardens on each side of the house. The area near the water wasn't as open as at home, with more buildings crowded near each other, making narrow passages for the wind to blow through, bringing all the smells, good and bad, with it. Wood smoke, thick enough to choke you, was everywhere. The sounds of people seemed all around me, calling to each other, some laughing, and serious discussions among deep-voiced men as they walked. I noticed that there were not a lot of children playing and yelling as they did back in Ipswich. Boston seemed a stern and serious place, something I never noticed on my few previous trips. Josiah came back out, saying something to Goodfield that I couldn't hear. "Come on, Jack," he called. I went to him, and we walked down towards the water. "Mr. Goodfield has decided to make you a cooper. The apprentice who worked for him isn't here anymore, so he needs someone to take his place," he said, flashing me a quick smile. "What do you think of that?" "I don't know," I replied. "I really don't care what he makes me do." "Now, it's not going to be that bad. He seems like a good man, and he assured me he'll look out for your best welfare. We'll be able to send you letters now and then, and we can see you if you're not busy when we come into town, which isn't all that often, but it will be good when we do." While it would be nice to see them, the only thing I heard was that I could receive letters. "Can anyone send me a letter?" I asked. "Well, I think so, but we only talked about your aunt and me. Why are you asking?" "Oh, just in case someone else wanted to send me a letter," I said, thinking of Becky. "And who might that be? How many people send you letters now? Do you expect to start getting a flood of them?" No, I don't. I was just wondering if I could get letters from anyone but you and Charity, that's all." "I'm sure you'll be able to. I don't see why not. Now, let's get your things." He was covering his real feelings by being too chipper about everything. The way he was acting just wasn't normal for him. He was a modern type, sometimes quiet, sometimes not, but always on an even keel. He was doing a poor job of trying to convince me that all is well. We walked back up the street to the cart. My things consisted of a small bag with all of the clothes I owned, or at least those I wasn't wearing, which wasn't many, a blanket and a few personal items. The most prized of them was a small pewter spoon that belonged to my mother. It was the only thing of hers I had taken with me. Just looking at it would bring back the memories of her that made me feel better. Josiah stood by the cart, rubbing his neck. He was uncomfortable with saying goodbye. "Well, you ought to go," I said, trying to make it easier for him. "I have to talk to Mr. Goodfield about the details of my arrangement. I hope this isn't going to be as bad as I think it is." I said that more to myself than to him. I could tell that it stung him the minute I said it. I didn't know what to say, so I didn't say anything at all. In a way, I felt that he deserved it since he was getting rid of me by dumping me with this fat old man. Scowling, I could not believe the circumstances in which I found myself. "Well," I said. "Well," he repeated. "Please ask Charity to send me a letter as soon as she can. I'll write you if Mr. Goodfield lets me. Take care of yourself, Uncle Josiah." With that, I turned and walked into the house, leaving him standing in front of the cart. It was not very nice of me, but at that point, I wasn't feeling nice at all. Goodfield stood at the other side of the room with his back to me. He turned and looked me up and down, walking around me once. I felt like I was some animal he was thinking of buying. When he finished, he grunted and left the room. A minute later, he came back with a short, plump woman wearing a nut brown dress with the cleanest, whitest apron I'd ever seen. She was wearing a cap with a widow's peak and had a kind look about her. She looked as pleasant as Goodfield did gruff. He grunted again and turned to her. "This is Jack," he said to the woman, who I assumed was Mrs. Goodfield. "Hello, Jack. I'm glad you came to us. You'll be sleeping in the garret with the other apprentices. There's a good mattress for you that was stuffed with corn and hay just last week. You'll eat your meals in the other room," she said, pointing behind her. "If you have any questions, which I'm sure you will, ask the other apprentices. They've been here for a while and know how things operate. I keep a clean house and don't tolerate any horseplay or rowdiness. I expect you to behave at all times. You do what you're told, and you'll get along fine." "Gordon," she said, bowing her head to her husband before she turned and walked out the room. Goodfield looked down his nose at me for a minute. "Well, don't just stand there, boy. Put your things in the garret and get back down here. The stairs are over there. Come down right away. The morning's wasted, but you can still work for a few hours. Remember this, you have to earn your place in my house. Now go." With that, I went up the stairs to find my place among the apprentices' pallets. The higher up I went, the hotter it got. Even though it was only June, I was sweating by the time I got to the top of the stairs. The only light came from two small windows on either side of the room. There were four pallets with thin mattresses on each. The three nearest to the stairs each had blankets and clothes hanging on pegs behind them, while the fourth was untouched. I put my sack down and sat on the mattress. It smelled of new hay and rustled with old corn leaves. Two small tables stood opposite the pallets. On each was a little candlestick with a fat stub of candle in them. It would be hot in the summer and freezing in the winter, since there wasn't a fireplace. I thought of how on a cold night I would sleep in front of the fire with Tink beside me. I didn't want to incur Godfield's wrath, so I hurried downstairs only to find him gone. I went from room to room looking for him. The size of the house amazed me because I didn't realize that one house could be this big and contain so many rooms. Any two of the rooms were the size of our entire house. I found him outside in the back. "I'm back, sir. And it's about time. What took you so long? Now, you're going to become a cooper. You'll be working under Jacob, the best cooper in Boston. He's worked for me for several years," he explained. "He won't tolerate any nonsense. You are here to learn and make me money. You do everything that Jacob tells you. He's worked with just one apprentice before, but the boy got sick and had to leave. I heard he died soon after that." "Oh, well," he said, dismissing the thought of the poor boy as easy as brushing off a fly. "Jacob is a good man, but has a short temper." With that, he began walking towards a building that looked like a warehouse. Before we got to it, he turned to the right, stopping in front of the cooperage. It was a small building, open on two sides to let the light in, with stacks of wood all around. Seated at the bench was a thin man with long arms and legs. He wore a gray, sweat-stained hat with a brim so wide that from the way he was sitting, I couldn't see his face. Long, dark hair hung down from under the hat, covering his ears and neck. His hands moved surely and smoothly over a piece of wood. He was making a long barrel stave. "Jacob," Goodfield said, "this is the new apprentice. Name is Jack. Just got here a while ago. I told you about him the other day. I want him to learn all there is about coopering. Work him hard." Goodfield went back to the house, leaving Jacob and me alone. He continued to work the stave, shaping it until it was just right. I stood watching, since I didn't have much else to do. He didn't speak until he was finished, which was a good 5 minutes. "So you want to be a cooper, eh?" he asked, raising his head and peering out from under the brim. I saw only half of his face, but it looked long and gaunt. A thin beard covered his pointed chin. "No, I don't. I want to be a farmer." "Well, well, Goodfield's given me a boy to teach who doesn't even want to learn. That's not a good way to start, you know. I have better things to do with my time than spend it on someone like you." "I never said I couldn't be a cooper, and a good one at that. I never said I didn't want to learn, either. You asked me if I wanted to be a cooper, and I said no, which is the truth. But I never said I couldn't be." He leaned the stave against a half-finished barrel. As he sat up, I saw how skinny he was. He looked like he weighed less than I did. "All right," he said, "that's fair. You answered the question honestly. Now let's talk a bit so we understand each other. Come over here and sit down," he said, motioning me to a three-legged stool. I moved it so I was facing him. "Tell me how you came to be here. Did your father send you here?" "No, he couldn't have. My father is dead. My mother died 2 years ago, giving birth to my brother. I live with my aunt and uncle, but they sent me here. They said this would be good for me, that I'd learn more and have a greater opportunity for a better life." He sat there looking at me, considering what I told him. "What town are you from?"
"Ipswich."
"How old are you?"
14.
"So you're all alone now?"
"Well, no, not really. I have my aunt and uncle, and I have my dog Tink. That's short for Tinker."
"Yes, I'm sure it is," he said, a small smile appearing on his long, drawn face. He got up and began pacing in front of me across the open end. "I want you to know that I'm not like Goodfield. I work for him because I'm a very good cooper, and he pays me well. I don't believe in beating people down to get what you want. I'll teach you all that I can, but you have to be willing to learn. If you're not, tell me now, and I'll speak with Goodfield so he can find something else for you to do." From what little I knew about Jacob,
He seemed to be a reasonable man. It occurred to me that I might do worse than to learn from him, and that I could work with someone who wasn't as tolerant. I realized that I was stuck here and might as well make the most of it, learning whatever I could. He looked down at me while I gave the matter a little more thought. I stood up and saw that he was a good foot taller than I was and didn't seem as old as I first thought. "I'll work with you," I told him. "I'll learn all that you can teach me and do the best I can." "That's good. I'm glad. You seem like a good boy. I will teach you all that I can." He did just that. Over the next 2 months, I learned much about being a good cooper and became skilled at turning out buckets, barrels, hogsheads, piggins, and firkins. Jacob was pleased with my progress and never hesitated to tell Goodfield, who seemed like he could care less how I was doing as long as I made him money. During the next few days, the other apprentices and I came to know each other. We talked of home, friends, things we missed, and hopes for the future, as well as the good and bad points of working for Goodfield. John Smith was from Duxbury, which was south of Boston. Rich Brown came from Roxbury, and Will Preston hailed from the small town of Marlborough, which was 20 miles west of Boston. John, a tall, lanky boy who was training as a blacksmith, didn't want to be here any more than I did. Rich was glad to be working as a tanner, although the stink from the animal hides followed him everywhere, sometimes making conversing with him difficult on a hot day when the wind was blowing from behind him. Will was enjoying himself and learning as much as he could about becoming a good carpenter. He was a short, somewhat chunky boy with a small, fuzzy beard covering his upper lip and chin, who whistled a soft tune most of the time. There are certain memories that stay with us, ones that bring back the sights, sounds, and smells of a certain time and place. Some of the sharpest from my time at Goodfield's is of heat, sweat, dead fish, and the smell of wood shavings. The warehouse was dark, hot, and humid, and the cooperage less so because of the open sides. It seemed that I was sweating all the time. It ran down my face, neck, back, and legs, and my clothes stuck to my body all the time. The only thing that I liked was working with Jacob, because it was outside where the wind blew and the smell of the freshly sawn wood was all around me. It was the only thing that took my mind off the situation in which I found myself. You have been listening to Backyard Bookshelf, a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. I'm Charlene, and thank you for listening.
Audio Journal, the radio reading service of Central Massachusetts, serving visually and print-impaired listeners since 1987. Audio Journal is a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.
This is a public service announcement from the Massachusetts Association for the Blind. The Massachusetts Association for the Blind and Visually Impaired provides assistive technology training for persons with visual impairments. If you or a family member are interested in receiving one-on-one specialized training, please contact 617-991-7073 or email atcenter@mabcommunity.org.